So it seemed that the question of what happened to Frank had been answered once and for all. It had been answered by that official death certificate I'd obtained from Mexico with the assistance of the American Embassy. He was dead. It said so, in black and white. But I still didn't quite believe it. Who, after all, was to say that the man who had died in the rich people's hospital in Tijuana had been Frank? Who had identified him? Who knew the dead man was Frank? I had asked the hospital person how they had identified the patient. She had seemed startled. It was, I had been told, a very exclusive hospital in one of the most luxurious neighborhoods in Tijuana. Why would there have been a question of identity? Wasn't the man admitted who he said he was? What had happened to his body? I asked. She said the family had taken it, and from what she knew, it had been buried. But who was the family? That woman who had brought Frank to the hospital, she guessed. The woman who also had later died, I had been told, when I had called her house, the phone number she had given on the hospital records. The person who answered the phone, she said she was the longtime maid or housekeeper, said that Frank had rented a room there from the owner of the house, who was the person who had taken him to the hospital. But that woman, too, had died not long after Frank. Who were these people? What was Frank doing living in a rich neighborhood of Tijuana? However, Frank's Social Security disability file, which I'd obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, had provided pages of medical reports over a period of years, and it really did seem to indicate that he had been gravely sick, and from smoking, just like our mother had been, and he had died at just the same age as mother had, 62. That much seemed true. And then I had been convinced by the Social Security disability files blackened by multiple Xeroxing passport picture of him. That was a picture of Frank. There remained, however, so many unanswered questions. How had Frank managed to get his final care in one of the most expensive hospitals in Tijuana? His Social Security file said he'd worked driving a truck for a welfare agency. Who was that woman who had taken him to the hospital? And how was it that she, too, had died not long after he had? What was he doing living in Tijuana in her house if his Social Security file said he lived in San Diego? There were so many more intriguing mysteries that remained unanswered, but I wasn't entirely sure that I really wanted to know more about Frank. Not at all sure I wanted to find out about who knows what other crimes he had committed. But when a friend mentioned that he personally knew a private detective, I hired him to do at least a cursory search for more information. Several weeks later, I got a report from the detective, who had, by the way, a completely improbable name, like a detective in a Raymond Chandler novel. I got the report in a spiral-bound gray booklet, the image of a fortress on the cover, and "Personal and Confidential" written in capital letters on each page. The detective had discovered just one fact that I had not already found out by myself. Frank had rented a post office box in someone else's name, and that someone else was dead. The sister of the dead man had been identified as someone who lived at the same address as Frank at one point. The detective wrote, "This raises the possibility that the subject, my brother, assumed the name of this person after his death and may have had some type of relationship with the dead man's sister." Oh, boy. Did I really want to proceed any further? I decided, no. Frank was dead. There remained fascinating unanswered questions, but I was done. Frank's first wife, my former sister-in-law, who I had known since I was 10 years old, had had a stroke, and I wanted to see her again. We'd kept in touch. I valued especially all she shared with me about mother and my family and about her sad experiences with Frank. but I had not been back to Cincinnati, where she still lived, for over 40 years. After a quick flight from Chicago, I got picked up by her second husband, a strong man who had spent his entire life working outdoors, building roads, who took me to see her in a rehabilitation hospital. She could speak, though her speech was a little slurred. Her husband's solicitousness was in such sharp contrast to my father's care for mother when she had been so ill. Later, back at my hotel, I decided to take a bus to my childhood neighborhood and see if I could see the house we had lived in when all five of us children were still at home, including Frank. I got off the bus close to our old street. It was May, and everything was green and flowering, filling my nostrils with a moist, living fragrance that catapulted me back into the past. I had lived in this house, in this neighborhood, through all middle childhood years, had walked these blocks to my school. As I strolled up to our old home, a tall, yellow brick house built about 1900, with a large front porch and a heavy wooden and glass door, that same door that had once shut on my fingers, I saw someone at an upper window and rang the bell. An attractive blonde woman in her 30s opened it. She had a friendly face and manner, and when I told her I used to live there, she invited me in. She told me she was very interested in the history of the house and would be glad to hear whatever I could tell her of it. As she took me on a tour, memories I didn't know I had kept springing up. The feel of the stairway's carved wood newel post, the glass-knobbed door handles upstairs, the room next to the master bedroom, my parents' room, where I remembered lying on my stomach looking at pictures from the photograph book The Family of Man and perusing the New Yorker magazines. The third floor, where Frank had once had his room, then, later, after he had moved out, I had had mine. As we descended the narrow back stairs to the kitchen, the owner asked me if I might know anything about a mural they had found painted on a wall of the kitchen when they'd replaced a cupboard. She showed me a picture she had taken of it before it had been covered up. It was Mother's charming painting, though mottled with age, of loaves of bread and fishes, with her printed, "The eyes of all wait upon thee, O Lord, for thou givest them their meat in due season. Thou openest thine hand, and fillest all things living with plenteousness." With five children to feed, and my father's fecklessness, Mother must have had reason to believe that the Lord would provide. The owner kindly promised to send me a copy of her photograph of Mother's mural. She was pleased to unexpectedly find the answer to her wondering about who had painted that, and I was pleased to be given this glimpse of Mother's artistic effort. When our tour and our conversation ended, as the owner was walking me to the front door, she said, "Someone else stopped by here a few years ago. He was driving by and stopped to say he used to live here in the 50s. The hair rose on my arms. I said, "But we lived here in the 50s. She said, "He said he had gone to the nearby high school and his room had been up on the third floor." Frank was the only one of us five children who had gone to that high school. His room had been on the third floor. "He was about 6 feet tall with graying hair. He was really nice," she said. "That sounds like my brother Frank," I said. "But when was this?" I asked. "I don't remember exactly," she said, "but we've only lived in this house since 1998. I walked away from the house in a daze. Frank had died the year before. Hadn't he?